The following is a recording of a discussion group at Ordinary Mind Zendo. The texts we take up for study in these groups range from koan collections to poetry to psychoanalytic papers. If you enjoy listening, please consider donating. Ordinary Mind Zendo is a nonprofit organization that depends on the generosity of people like you.
All right, let's see what we have here.
Today's the 13th, right?
Somebody want to read this? One day in an address, Zen Master Zungli quoted, "Buddha had a secret saying, Kasyapa didn't conceal it." Hearing this, Zijian suddenly realized the mystic meaning. He wept as he stood there, unconsciously blurting out, "Why haven't we heard this before?" After this lecture, Zungli summoned Zijian and asked him why he had been weeping in the teaching hall. Zijian said, "Buddha had a secret saying, but Kasyapa didn't conceal it." Zungli gave him approval and said, "You must be the one Yunju predicted long ago."
Yeah, our translation somewhat different. Here it says, "The world-honored one spoke with a hidden meaning, but it was not concealed to Kasyapa." I would imagine it's not concealed from Kasyapa. "When the master heard this, he was suddenly awakened to its profound meaning. Standing there in the ranks with the others, his tears fell, and he unconsciously burst out, 'Why hadn't I heard this before?'" Tsung Chu finished his talk and summoned the master and asked, "Why were you weeping?" And the master replied, "The world honored one spoke with a hidden meaning, but it was not concealed to Kasyapa."
It makes a big difference.
Yeah.
It has, I think it has a different flavor to it. Couple points on the form of this. I think that when he says, "Why are you weeping?" and he responds with a repetition, in a sense, it's a model of the way answers are not separate from the question, or the answer is found within the question itself. Particularly when there's a why question.
Why do you put your robes on?
Do you put your robes on at the sound of the bell? The sound of the bell, I put on my robes. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, there's a way in which why is a kind of question that asks what's behind X, right? Mm-hmm. What's the reason, justification, or cause of X? And in a lot of koans, the answer is just X, right? There's nothing behind X, there's just X, right? Mm-hmm. And this koan also is of that form in which we're presented with, there is a secret meaning, but it's not hidden. Well, it's not hidden, right? There's a good book out called "Nothing Is Hidden." Right? That's the idea of this koan, right?
This does that better though, because yours doesn't explain why it seems to be like this. Is like it's. It's like it's right in front of you.
What did I just say about why?
But this says like it's the way like when you're looking for something and it's right in front of your nose.
Yes, it's not. The dilemma here is what? Yes, what does it mean that? He speaks with a hidden meaning, but it was not concealed. You see, I think that it's why is it a hidden meaning?
Because you're not going to get.
Because you're not recognized.
Yeah.
You know, or there's an aspect of it you're not recognizing. It's like the saying, it's not the early bird who gets the worm, it's the bird that knows a worm when it sees one. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's some... See, what we want to say here is that he speaks with a concealed meaning, that there's something more to his words than what ordinary people are hearing. And yet, it's not like there's a secret meaning, or it's rather that more is being expressed than people understand. Now we'll try to see from the rest of the case and the discussion what that is trying to refer to.
So does it mean that the disciples or the students would need to come to a level of awakening and consciousness that would permit to recognize what is
yes.
sort of concealed?
Yes. That's right, that there's a certain awakening is sort of awakening to this double perspective, or this perspective in depth, right?
Was it like when Wittgenstein asks, how come people didn't realize that the Earth rotates around the sun?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the other guy says, well, it looks like the sun rotates around the Earth. And Wittgenstein says, well, what it would look like if the Earth rotated around the sun.
Right.
So is it just
a funny question, yeah, that's right.
Being recognizing that this is right in front of your nose, but you can't see it.
Yes, or that... you don't see that you're seeing evidence for what you're seeing evidence for right in front of you. That this is how it would look if the Earth rotated around the sun, right? You think you're seeing evidence for the sun rotating yeah. the Earth, but the evidence hasn't changed, but all of a sudden you realize you've interpreted the whole thing backwards, right?
It's like there's a duck in that rabbit.
Yeah, yeah. The duck rabbit is that kind of perceptual shift.
But is that a different, you know, is that different consciousness, or is that different level of practice, or is that just a perspective shift?
Well, it was a perspective shift, a level of consciousness shift. I mean, what does that mm-hmm. mean? You know, I mean, it's. It's also like the equivalent of your mood changing.
But is it possible that to come to this awakening is through suffering?
Well, you could... It would be like a shift on your perspective of what suffering is. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the basic shift around suffering that people go through is that we see suffering as an intrusion in our life, that something has gone wrong, that in some way we've been singled out, or that we're they're going something that's a result of something being unfair or a mistake. I mean, there's all these kinds of ways in which suffering is experienced as intruding and ruining my life, right?
Mm-hmm. This shouldn't be happening.
Right, and the shift that happens is that you see that life is suffering. You see that this is just your life happening. The suffering isn't something extraneous to life. This is what life is. Oh my God, I'm getting old, right? That's, right?
Yeah. Stop it.
Right? That's not something that has befallen me. That's something that is me, right? Mm-hmm. I can't be me in any way unless I'm embodied and in time, right? There's not a me that age is happening to, right? Or, right? So it's that, it involves that kind of shift, right?
That's funny, because that's Shugen in when in this intro to Buddhism and Zen class. Mm-hmm. He says, yeah, Buddha said life is suffering. What is suffering? Mm-hmm. I think it's like a long list, and no. Mm-hmm. And the answer he's waiting for is life again.
Life.
Right. And that's such a great, like, you know, because it's right, you know, it's the first simple truth. It's,
right. And the whole way the Four Noble Truths are framed is as if they're going to give you a way out of life.
The first one.
That there's a cause and end to suffering, and if you just do all this stuff,
get away
from the first one. But really, all of them lead you back to the first one from a different perspective. Right?
The problem I always have with life is suffering is that life isn't only suffering. I mean, every moment is not suffering.
Well, again, it's what counts, or how suffering gets defined. And see, in a technical sense, it means that everything about life is subject to, is impermanent and subject to contingency. And that the state, even the states of pleasure, are transient and uncontrollable. Mm-hmm. So that they are, and that what we usually think of as self is an attempt to, or a strategy to control the uncontrollable. So that whatever we're engaged, any moment we're engaged in from a self-centered perspective is a perspective in which we're trying to deny impermanence or contingency. We're trying to have a degree of control over our experience that is sort of structurally impossible. And that even when we have pleasurable experiences, from a self-centered perspective, we want to make them last or be just right, or have them be completely under our control and not dependent on what the other person is doing, or not spoiling my experience. Right? So all of these things are going to be suffering in that they're going to resist your attempt to control them.
I agree with Julie in the sense that I think that perspective is available to people periodically. Mm-hmm. Like parents will have this experience with their kids, or you know, like artists in certain moments where there's completeness. Mm-hmm. So I think in that sense, I mean, life is still suffering, but
then this moment just passes. Right?
Yeah.
There's a sense of there's a moment when mm-hmm. the pleasure gives way mm-hmm. to the attempt to retain it.
Yeah. Yes, and that's right.
And that's when the suffering happens. Yeah.
So it's bittersweet. So you feel that completeness that you needed to let go. Mm.
Yes, and whether you get that feeling on a cushion or any other way, the whole cycle of trying to hold on to it is what gives rise to clinging or addiction in more literal, you know, ways, right? But clinging is that word for trying to get into one state and stay there, right?
But those moments of completeness, those moments of pleasure, are exist. And
sure, yeah, but we have the question is. Is both our relationship to them and right. our understanding of what's happening in those moments. When Buddha or Shakyamuni looks up and sees the twinkling star, there's this moment of perfection and completeness, but it is has depth because it's not separate from the twinkling, from the changing of the star, and from the and the whole sense of identity with this changing contingent world, right? But for most people,
it's specific to a content.
It's a specific content that all of a sudden I've had this moment and I want it to last longer, or at least I want to have it again. That's usually what
happens.
What
did I do to get it?
And
how can I replicate
it? How can I replicate it? So it immediately, you know, it's, you know, the paradox is, you know, I had this experience of oneness. And that that was different from every other experience I've ever had, right? You immediately create a dichotomy, a new dualism between that and every other experience. And so part of what happens in this koan is to see that that is present in every moment regardless of its content, right? That. And we have to see what is it. In general, the dilemma of these kinds of koans is that people get to some place of emptiness and see that in distinction to the rest of their life or other states, and that there has to be a perspective shift when that emptiness becomes a aspect of all other states, not in contrast to other states. And then it's not concealed because it's part of everything else. Right?
It's cute that he says, "Why haven't we heard this before?"
Yeah.
As though. You know.
Yeah. Well, I think it's more like how come I never realized this?
Yeah.
This is how come I didn't get it.
I have that a lot.
Uh-huh. How could, it's so goddamn obvious.
It was
how
right
in front
of
me. That's right.
So can you summarize what you just said?
Wow.
Let's just keep let's going. We'll just keep saying the same thing over and over again.
Oh, that often
all
helps.
Right? That's usually what
I still don't get it. That's all right.
Yes, all right. Let's see here. The situation described in the koan of Kasyapa and Shakyamuni is in the Nirvana Sutra. Once Kasyapa said to Buddha, O world-honored one, according to what Buddha has said, all Buddhas, world-honored ones, speak with a hidden meaning. But this is not what he means. Why? All Buddhas have a hidden meaning, but not a hidden body of teaching. It's like a magician's mechanical man. Even though people see it lean over, stretch, look up and down, they do not realize there's something inside it that makes it the way it is. The Buddha Dharma is not like that, but instead allows people to understand completely. how could it be said that Buddhas have a secret body of teaching? And the Buddha praised Kāśyapa, very, very good, good son. As you say, the Tathagata truly has no secret body of teaching. All right, so just as the full moon is clear and exposed in the sky, pure and unobscured and seen by everybody, so are the Tathagata's words. He utters them clear and exposed, pure and unobscured. Deluded people say it is a secret body of teaching, but the wise understand completely and do not call it a secret body of teaching. So the mechanical man, again, is an image of what we think we're asking with why questions, or what's going on inside or behind the scenes that is making something happen.
Of a black box.
Yeah, of what's inside. A black box is renouncing asking what's inside. You sort of say you don't care what's inside. It's a black box. But it's more like what's the... you're asking the particulars of the hardware, the software that gives this output, right? there was, believe in the 18th century, a famous mechanical duck that somebody made that ate and defecated and flew and everything. It was like they were trying to model what the body as machine, and it was sort of the first eliminativist picture of the soul, that life will be reduced to something mechanical like this. It doesn't need animation from the outside. So here, what we've got is this question: is there something behind the scenes? And Buddha is saying, no. Everything is contained completely in what I'm saying and what is visible to everybody.
I think that's an important part, is that it's like comparing this to Christianity. The robot image makes me think like there's an aspect of it that's inaccessible. Uh-huh. Like of a different realm.
Uh-huh. Of a different realm, that's right.
But however, I have a sense that in Buddhism that is also an interpretation that brings to mysticism and this other world with, you know, the dead and hungry ghosts and so on, that can also lead to this notion that things are concealed and only few will know.
I think that there are unquestionably sort of aspects of all religions where a priesthood sets it up as themselves up as the guardian of esoteric secrets.
Right.
They everybody can't resist.
Right. They just can't resist being in that position. Zen, in a sense, tried to present itself as the opposite of that kind of esotericism by being the practice of sort of absolute immediacy. So, you know, it's the when someone asks you what is the hidden meaning of Zen, you hit them upside the head, right?
I think that has become I think that's become a mechanical man in a way. Immediacy is turned into this mysterious, inaccessible thing sometimes.
Uh-huh. Well, that's sort of, it's peculiar that immediacy can be esoteric. I mean, it's supposed to be the opposite of anything, right? But you get these koans where somebody is sort of saying, what's the deepest teaching, and gets hit. It happens over and over again, and finally they realize they're being given the answer, not being denied the answer, right? That immediacy is the teaching.
But I think the question of karma too, and reincarnation, brings some mysticism to Zen as well.
Yes, and that's a lot of cultural woo-woo that we simply do not bring over into Western American Buddhism.
Maybe we don't bring here, but other places.
But Zen, is that part of Zen?
No,
karma,
it's part of
Tibetan Buddhism.
It's part of Asia. It's part of a whole cultural milieu there that Buddhism existed in and played with.
Karma is definitely Zen.
Karma means cause and effect, but is part of contingency, interdependency.
Right.
It doesn't have anything to do with past and future lives in a literal sense.
Shugan doesn't doubt that either.
So what?
What?
Shugan, he doesn't doubt reincarnation either. He does not... he doesn't say this is not the focus, but he does not dismiss it in a way. It's a possibility. It leaves it.
I think he makes a show of doing that, though.
Yeah.
Because he's very quick to dismiss people when they try to treat Kanon like a being.
Mm-hmm.
So it's.
As if there's an actual goddess in another realm.
Well, when someone. Because people have asked about. You know, can I pray to Kanon? And he's very quick to be like, you're talking to yourself. Like, it's fine, but...
well, that's what you're
that's
doing.
Good, you know.
But I think the...
pray to the cat, you know, I mean, it's like...
I think that has to do with, like, him modeling not knowing more than leaving room for reincarnation.
Yeah, maybe.
Could be.
You could ask him.
We should...
I guess. I've forgotten who Shugan is...
No, the abbot up there on the mountain, Zen Mountain.
Zen Mountain.
There.
Right, right.
He's a Hoshi.
Right. I've just forgotten.
There was a nice blog post by Eve Marco as she headed off to Austin, titled "I Never Pretended to Be a Mountain," which is a very nice expression. You know, it's. Because she talks about just all her own inner confusion or turmoil or difficulty, and that her job as a teacher is to simply to be present to that and honest about it, and to acknowledge the completely contingent nature of her existence, and not act as if, as a teacher, I am this unchangeable, indomitable force in the world, right?
Susan Moon is good at that, too.
Mm-hmm. Dido, not so much.
No.
He was more of a, I am the mountain. You know?
Well, I think some people are handicapped by the fact that they look the part, and then they get stuck playing the part.
That's just an excuse.
He groomed himself to look the part. That's part of the, he thought that was part of the job description.
To look the part?
Yeah. I guess I have an advantage of being naturally charisma-free.
That's not true. That's part of your charisma, to be able to say that.
Yeah, that's right.
I agree.
Let me see what I want to...
Actually, to Adriana's point, there's a part in here where he does talk about like a state that's useful for this.
Where is it?
Therefore, to let people know this realm, teachers use unlimited expedient methods to cause senses to stop, making everything cease. At this point, there is something that cannot be obliterated. There is something that cannot be destroyed. But that seems to suggest that it is like a state of consciousness.
Yeah, well, that's always the dilemma of this. And you want to say that... sort of the first move of training is where he says, when you hear words, you must know their inner meaning and not get trapped by the words. Saying fire is not fire, saying water is not water. Therefore, you do not burn your mouth when you say fire. Your mouth is not wet when you say water. So there's a way in which there is form and meaning, form and emptiness, and these distinctions have to first be understood so that you don't confuse the word with the thing, or you don't, we would say, simply. And confusing the words for the thing, in a sense, is also confusing the thing with a stable referent, a solid, unchanging essence. So, when you get in the Heart Sutra, sort of saying, no, I hear no thing, body, mind, part of what they're saying is there are no elements of that experience can be reduced to, right? You know, the whole idea of an element in nature is that it is a irreducible
fundamental
building block, right? The Heart Sutra lists each realm of the senses, you know, sight or sound or taste, color thing, even thinking, and sort of saying the temptation is to say that, like say in John Locke, your mind is a blank slate and you build up the world through sense experiences, through sense data. And sense data are going to be these irreducible elements of experience, and that if you want to be scientific, what you do is you try to look at the particular sense data that you're accumulating and drawing conclusions from. But the assumption is that there is a kind of bedrock of sense data to which everything can be reduced.
The assumption is also that the thing that you're taking in the sense data with is itself not reducible.
You mean like your eyes and your nose, your ears?
Like their skandhas too.
But that's the next step of that. That not only are the data not elemental, but your consciousness thinking and conceptualizing is not a solid given thing. Right?
What's that? I mean, like, is this? Does he suppose the slate is elemental as well?
Well, he had a big problem explaining how sense data were organized once they came in,
mm-hmm.
right? But he wanted to have this. He was trying to build up a sense data notion of knowledge. Which, you know, is a in some ways looks like a good start, but it creates a lot of problems.
It seems to me that's a lot of intellectual work, and I wonder if someone is smart and very comfortable with abstract thinking can actually learn how to recognize and decode this way, these teachings, and really sound very enlightened, but not quite integrated with life. I think it's one of the...
Well, look, I think that... you get both a complicated Indian and Chinese philosophy trying to articulate
mm-hmm.
the consequences of seeing the world this way, trying to say, what does it mean that there are no elements of experience? They get into complicated discussions about whether there is sort of capital M mind that everything is an expression of. Their philosophy gets as mixed up as ours in a lot of ways, although they, when Westerners confront Eastern philosophy, they think it's revelation and they're not allowed to question it the same way we question in the West. But part of nothing is hidden is also not to try to go to this anti-intellectual mode of say, you know, where you say that illiteracy and immediacy are the highest forms, oh, and that we have to
banish thinking,
or all, and somehow break the ego through strenuous physical practice, you know, as if the only path to understanding is this kind of smashing of the ego, right? Where the ego is an enemy, the conceptualizing ego is an enemy that has to be vanquished. A lot of what they're talking about here is people having gone through all of that to get out of intellectualizing, to come to some state of thought-free immediacy or emptiness, and then coming back, so that they don't think that that's a special state behind the scenes, but how do you come back and see words as things like flowers and leaves and rocks, right? That's, words are not more or less empty than rocks and trees, right? We're not trying to get, you know, to a state where...
or the self, for that matter.
Or the self, right. Yeah. The self is non-existent, but so is the floor. in exactly the same way, right?
In the Vipassana retreat that I went to in the spring, one of the participants asked perfectly in earnest, is mindfulness thoughtlessness?
Uh-huh.
And I just, you know, it struck me as so funny because of our connotation, our definition of thoughtlessness, which is sort of like carelessness. You know, we're going to, I wasn't thoughtful. I didn't, you know, take this person into consideration. But it's so interesting because, you know, I think that a woman who was with me, who's a teacher, and I brought this up to her afterwards, she said, I would have said yes. Mindfulness is thoughtlessness.
Yeah, well, that's what's sort of wrong with a whole way of approaching practice. And I think it's a good question because it's... almost everybody's curative fantasy.
Exactly. It's very illuminating to hear that question.
Yes, including some teachers who really think that what they're selling is a mind control technique, so that what we're trying to do is empty the mind of thought and attain a state of pristine mirror-like clarity.
And stay there.
And stay there. And that... the dilemma is that you may, if in some ways, pass through that state, but if you think that is a goal and that everything else is a contaminant of that, your whole life becomes a contaminant. And that's sort of the point of the Six Patriarchs poem of, you know, the there's no mirror and no place for dust to alight, and there's no there is no dust and no mirror. But that's the real dilemma. These people who want to hold out the fantasy of thought. A thought-free, clear mind as what we're aiming for.
Who does that?
Well, almost everybody.
But I've been coming down on the other side of this lately, because I've, with this AA group, I've had to think about this a lot, because the type of meditation they do is very much bring the mind back to the breath and focus. And I've come to, so my little theory of how that's useful is that, like, that state can be like having like sun on a grassy field or something, like it seems restorative for these people.
Yeah, no, it's very it's a technique, and it's a technique that has uses, and that's what distinguishes it from Zen.
Right. Yeah. So I say, I'm like, that's good. It's not Zen.
But it's fine. But you see, it's a step, yeah. And it's a dilemma, because even though it's useful, it can be misleading about what happens next or what the alternative to that is. If somebody is in a anxious, tumultuous, self-hating place, they can use a technique to quiet themselves down, to get all that crap out, to learn to feel settled and relaxed and contained, and having them count their breaths or label their thoughts gives them solidity where before there was just buzzing confusion, right?
Yeah.
I do not begrudge anybody that, and people may need to do that for a long time or forever. But
it seems like the only dilemma is that if you try to project what you think, where it should quote unquote go.
Yes, to extrapolate to that is a big problem, right? And that becomes the mind is contaminated by its contents. You're trying to endlessly sweep it clean, right? However, you can, if you do that kind of practice, or Joko's labeling practice for a long time, and your mind settles down, and you see thoughts just as thoughts after a while, just a lot of thoughts passing by as empty, you may suddenly have one of those shifts where the thoughts are empty, they're not contaminants. It doesn't matter whether they're in your mind or on the mirror or any place else. They all of a sudden the presence of thought and the presence of feeling is not a problem. Right? It's simply your mind. Right? And then there's a switch into a completely different way of being at ease in your own mind. You're at ease not because all this stuff has gone away, but because all this stuff is in some sense empty and is just there. And it doesn't make any difference at all that it's there, right? It's not a problem. And that's where Zen is kicking in, right? And it is a qualitatively different turn of the dial. Right?
To me, the key there is judging. Mm-hmm. That when you reach a, maybe I'm wrong, but when you reach a point where you're not judging that as good or bad or anything.
Yeah, I think that not judging is sort of the manifestation of that.
I think it's the containment that helps, because it happened with me when I started meditating. I was so not well regulated that my mind seems to be spinning when I was in meditation. It was the first time I did it. So, and as I practice that and start with counting the breath as well, things start to change and switch naturally. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, I needed that type of containment. Mm-hmm. And I don't think if I would advance in, you know, in techniques or whatever would help, be helpful. Mm-hmm. I need a lot of contentment.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting because this is a useful reminder, because like Zen doesn't have a prescription for a practice in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's like people really don't know how to get people from A to B.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about like one day this woman came and like I didn't have time to tell her to like sit and feel her breath or like whatever. So I just showed her to, you know, sit there and just sit there. And after she was crying, and afterwards she's the CEO of this startup, and she's like, I've never been allowed to just sit there. And I was like, wow, you know, like some people would consider that advanced. It's so funny.
Been allowed to what? Just sit.
Yeah, but in a weird way, like she had this extreme level of stress. So it was
probably a great level of stress. Of, you're always supposed to be doing something. And to say just sit there is you're off the grid of trying to do anything. And, you know, that's what I try to explain to people at great length, and yet you just somehow are able.
Maybe they have to be CEOs first.
I was thinking the first time I sat at home, and there was just an enormous feeling of relief,
mm-hmm.
and also realization of how exhausted I was.
That's right.
Oh God! You know, I'd been through a hard time, and it just to be a lot. That permission to just...
Yes, and I think that is, in a certain sense, that's a kind of beginner's mind experience. The first time you sit down, you just have the relief of just sitting there, being able to feel how tired you are, and to just be able to sit that way over and over and over again. Would be a wonderful thing, but most people
I wish it would come back
you know, mess it up by, you know, inevitably trying to do something more, right, than that, right? It's hard to get back to I'm just really just sitting here.
Permission is a good keyword for that.
Yeah.
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 For me, the containment actually worked both different ways. It helped me to settle down, but because I was at the monastery for the first time, I really was meditating. At night, I had nightmares that I could not move, that I was locked in certain. I woke up screaming because I needed to get out of that structure and rigidity. So it worked both ways.
Yeah, what do you mean by containment, though?
It's like when, you know, life is falling apart and you are bumping every place you go, and you need it to settle down. You have the containment, which is the instructions that you receive and the place and the time. Mm-hmm. Everything that contains you helps to contain the mind.
Yeah. Well, it's partly the act of sitting itself, because you're still.
Right.
So the stillness of the body then theoretically starts to move to the
And at the monastery, if you move, you've got to be still. And pain, you've got to deal with your pain no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So that is really a good point.
And people, Joko is more explicit about it, that, you know, that the point of sitting with some physical pain is that to make it a, you know, a correlate for emotional pain, that if you can sit still with this, sit still with how you feel, you know, right?
Why would that, why is there, I don't see how that, why is that
equivalent? Because what you're doing is you're training yourself to not be immediately reactive and avoidant in the face of pain, so that it ought to be, if I can sit with my knee hurting and not move and not do anything, maybe if you insult me and I feel hurt, I don't immediately have to lash out back at you. I could say, oh, wait a minute, that hurts. I know how to sit still with something that hurts. I have a little room to think before I react. And it's supposed to create that capacity of staying with something rather than immediately avoiding or reacting.
Yeah.
But land also.
But it's often not made explicit in monastery settings that that has anything to, one has anything to do with the other, right? You're supposed to develop that on your own or behind the scenes.
But does it have anything to do? I mean,
it helps to make it explicit. People get
the
idea.
I think now with more women in the monastery, and not just Dogas and Mountain, more and more Zen has become more embodied. And they talk more about
embodied and psychological is not a dirty word. And emotional is not a dirty word, right? Yeah. All right, I'll stop here. Thank you all.
Thank you.